This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode about the mysteries of consciousness. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. When somebody is in a coma after a serious brain injury, the main thing their family members want to know is, when will they wake up? And what will they be like if and when they do? And these questions are really hard to answer. Even with the latest brain scan technology that shows which parts of the brain are damaged and how extensive the damage is. This is an area of medicine where the more researchers are learning, the more questions they have. Alan Yu reports.
2 years ago, Cassie Wolf had graduated from college. She was 23 and working full-time on a farm and a trucking business. One night, she went out dancing with her sister at a restaurant in Pennsylvania. Suddenly, Cassie collapsed in the bathroom. An ambulance took her to a local hospital. Her mother, Anne Louise Weaver, rushed over. Doctors took Anne Louise and the other family members into a small private room and told them that Cassie's heart had stopped.
She suffered a stroke at the same time because she went without oxygen for quite a while, and that she was fighting for her life and most likely would not make it through the night.
Anne Louise and Cassie's younger sister Hallie stayed at the hospital anxiously waiting for news, while machines and medications kept her alive. Doctors found out Cassie had an undetected genetic heart condition. 2 days later, doctors told Anne Louise they thought Cassie would survive. And that's when a new reality dawned on Anne Louise.
When I had talked to the doctor, the surgeon who did her second life-saving procedure, I asked him, when would be the soonest that I would be able to talk to her if this worked and she survived? And he said it would be at least 3 weeks till I could have a conversation with her.
Cassie would need specialized care. When she was stable, a medical helicopter took her to a hospital in Philadelphia. Anne Louise rented an Airbnb to stay close to her daughter.
Just basically camped out beside her from, you know, morning till bedtime. I would try to go home and sleep at the Airbnb to get, because the staff was very adamant that as the parent, you get sleep.
Cassie was unconscious for weeks. During this time, doctors met with Anne Louise to talk about what Cassie's future might look like.
They had told us initially when she was still in a coma, she will come out of it, but it could be anywhere from a vegetative state to I'm going to need some help on my forms.
While Cassie remained unconscious, her doctors asked Anne Louise to think about what Cassie might want, given the situation.
They were asking me, you know, on behalf of your daughter, what do you feel she would need? What would be considered a meaningful recovery? What would be considered a manageable life for her? You know, those are really hard, hard questions to answer for a child and also as the family.
Anne Louise says she thought about her daughter's disposition. Cassie is strong, fierce, a fighter. One time, Cassie broke her nose when a cow kicked her in the face. And she set the broken bone by herself because she did not want to go to a hospital.
I felt she would at least need to be able to get around on her own. It wouldn't feel like a meaningful life to her if we had to lift her and she had to be in a wheelchair and completely dependent.
When I finally actually woke up, I was like, oh, well, this sucks.
This is Cassie. After about 2 months, she was conscious and slowly became able to communicate. Anne Louise says it happened very gradually.
Her mouth was starting to move and it seemed like she was trying to say things and she would start following people with her eyes. So we had these tiny little signs that she was starting to come back, but it took days and weeks and months. It was like watching her all over again as a little baby, discovering her hands, discovering movement, listening to sound. And so it was really endearing and beautiful, but also really scary to realize we're starting over and not knowing what that was going to be like and what that was going to require from her and from us. And, you know, when you wait for your child to wake up for so many weeks and weeks and weeks, and when they start to show any sign of communication and being there, it's such a joyous experience. Like, there they are.
But a lot of Cassie's memory was gone.
One day I walked into her hospital room and she looked at me just kind of with this sort of glazed look, and she said, "You look like my mom." And another time when her sisters came to see her, they were asking if she knew their name, and she couldn't. "I'm not sure." And you could tell there was recognition there, but her sister ran into the bathroom and just burst into tears. You know, she was 16 at the time and was just devastated that Cassie had woken up but didn't know her name. There's nothing like it going through that process with a loved one, waiting for them to come back, but then when they do, they're not who left you so quickly. And one of the best analogies that a doctor gave to me to help me understand this was, like, he said, when there's a medical crisis, it's like you fall into a canyon. You fall over a cliff into a canyon. And because it happens so fast, you think you can climb back up and out. But what actually happens is your journey out is like circling the canyon around and around and around at this slow grade until you finally can come up and out.
At first, Cassie could not sit in a wheelchair on her own. She had to be strapped in with a neck strap. Cassie had to learn how to walk, how to write, how to brush her teeth by herself.
I was like, we learned to walk. I was like, that can't be possible. That stuff had to all be relearned. And yeah, it was a lot. And I thought I could do all of that, and then couldn't even sit up straight.
Anne Louise says rehab was a difficult time for Cassie and for her.
You know, when you're a very, very independent 23-year-old, like fiercely independent, and then all of a sudden you can't move your fork to your mouth. I mean, there's really no way to describe the anguish and the fear that surrounds that. And no one can tell you if and when these things will ever happen.
Cassie finally left the hospital after 3 months. She's living at home with Anne Louise now and continues to recover. She's now able to do her hair and makeup, go outside, cook, and write. She still has therapy and is working towards living by herself. Anne Louise says life is very different now.
It does very much feel like the world has passed us by and we're in this strange, slow-moving time warp all of our own. But when you're in it and life has been compacted into this small existence, everything that is new that we're adding, it's like you keep the perspective that you're practicing and you're expanding to create a new type of life that is more interactive. And, you know, her tolerance for people and for busyness and for exertion, it is all growing, but slowly.
The life Cassie has now is very different from what she had imagined 2 years ago. But every small gain redefines what a meaningful recovery could look like for her. And she says her doctors are optimistic.
They really do think that I can go back to work eventually, like half time. And I mean, I don't see that, but I don't know what my heart and my brain will do together in the next few years. So the doctors are smarter than most people. So they think I'll drive, and I think I won't, but I want to. It's all up in the air. But I would love to try all that stuff again.
Neurologist David Fisher is one of the doctors at Penn Medicine in Philadelphia who helps care for Cassie. He created a program dedicated to helping patients like her recover consciousness. In the past, David says, doctors have looked at recovery in a simplistic way, whether a patient could live independently or not.
And I think that's in part because as physicians or really as people, we tend to not like gray areas. We tend to not like ambiguity. And it's easier when things are black and white and we can say that a prognosis is good or bad. You know, the challenge is that functional independence is not the end-all be-all for every family when they're trying to figure out what outcomes would be meaningful, particularly if the alternative is death.
He says now doctors try to get a sense of what will be important to an individual patient and their families. They have more tools like brain scans and advanced imaging techniques to study a patient's brain and body in ways that were not possible before. Broadly speaking, there are two kinds of tests he and the doctors can do now. Tests to check how much the brain has been damaged and where, and tests to see how well the brain is working.
All of these tests have certain drawbacks or limitations, and so the hope is that by collecting multiple tests, we can help correct for that and try to make the most accurate prediction we can about a patient's capacity to recover.
However, he says the more doctors and researchers learn about this, the more humble they become about how much they still do not understand.
Our ability to predict neurologic recovery is in general relatively poor. And so I think there's diminishing nihilism about patients' capacities to recover and an increasing humility about predicting those recoveries.
David says there have been studies where researchers sent data about a theoretical brain injury case to doctors around the country and asked for predictions.
What those studies have typically shown is that physicians are all over the place. There are some that are predicting good outcomes, some that are predicting bad outcomes. And we see that variability translate into practice. There are other studies that have shown that physicians are highly variable in how we prognosticate for our actual patients. The rates at which we withdraw life support are highly variable.
So two physicians looking at the same patient, the same brain scan data, could come to different conclusions about whether or not they predict that patient will make a recovery.
And I think certainly the concern is that if we are so variable in how we're doing this, that we're making some mistakes a certain portion of the time, and specifically are withdrawing life support prematurely for a subset of these patients.
He says there are some cases most doctors can agree on, but it gets very complicated when it comes to patients with mild to moderately severe brain injuries. And these patients often cannot get a second opinion.
These are patients who are in an intensive care unit at whichever hospital happens to have been closest to where their brain injury unexpectedly occurred. And families do not typically have the luxury to seek out second opinions. So whichever doctor you happen to have been stuck with is the one who may be deciding whether they live or die.
In these difficult situations, patient families and loved ones want clear answers. What's going to happen? But doctors are often not sure, says clinical neuroscientist Yelena Bodine. She used to work with rehab patients in Boston and is now a researcher at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. She says predicting recovery is hard, even with advanced brain scans.
You can actually look at a scan, a brain image, CT or MRI, and see global devastation. Multiple parts of the brain are injured. There's bleeding everywhere. And yet that person recovers. And you can see another scan where you don't see clearly that much damage and that person doesn't recover. And so our tools that we're using, in humans anyway, are just not sophisticated enough yet to see at a very granular level what exactly is happening enough to be able to correlate it or associate it with outcome.
She and other researchers say every brain injury is different. But her work has shown that people who are seemingly unconscious could actually be aware to some degree of what's happening, more so than doctors might have thought. For instance, a paper she worked on last year looked at almost 300 people in the US and Europe who could not respond to simple commands. But when they did brain scans, they found that some patients' brains were responding, even if their limbs were not.
So you can't see them wiggling their toes, but they can think about wiggling their toes, or they can think about opening and closing their hand, even though they don't actually do it at the bedside.
They found that 1 in 4 patients showed this covert form of consciousness, and followed commands.
And that number is really staggering, and I think has shown the world, really, not just our research world, but the world at large, how prevalent this phenomenon is, and has changed the conversation in many ways, in, from, you know, this is something that might happen once in a while, to this is probably something that is occurring in many patients who are not conscious or appear to be not conscious or not following commands at the bedside.
How physicians view a patient's potential for recovery can depend on what kinds of patients they see, says Jennifer Russo. She's a brain injury physiatrist at the Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation in New Jersey. Jennifer says rehab specialists treat patients who survived. They see what is possible, whereas her colleagues in the ICU have to work with patient families to make these life and death decisions. But they do not get the same picture.
They don't get the joy of getting to see people recover, and they don't always get to see the potential that some of these patients can have. That happens a lot, particularly for patients who've suffered anoxic brain injuries. It's sort of been thought that someone who's had a cardiac arrest or anything that's prevented blood flow and oxygen to get to their brain, that universally guarantees a bad outcome. That, and the counseling that the families will get in that acute state is that they'll never walk again, never talk again, never eat again, won't live independently. And it's not universally true. I have had multiple patients who are walking, talking, no feeding tube, no breathing tube, and are back to their lives. But I get to see that. I get that privilege.
For the patients who do make it, the journey back can be slow. Leona Giordano's son, Dom, was seriously injured in a motorcycle accident almost 2 years ago. He went from only moving his eyes in rehab to coming home to live with her.
Now he's able to pick up his arm and point to yes, no. He can move his left arm and scratch his head, rub his nose, reach for things. We play Connect Four now.
Jen Tompkins suffered a serious brain injury in a car accident more than 10 years ago. She is a little further along her recovery. She can walk around and even was able to do office work a few hours a week at a time.
I don't drive a car because my left side is like a stroke.
She wears braces on her left hand and foot to hold them in place.
I'm better, but I'm just determined still.
Susan Arnhold is more or less back to who she was before an accident where a car hit her when she was on her bike more than 4 years ago. She can do most things other than biking.
And I think that's the one thing I miss, is that I miss being able to ride in the sunshine on a real bike down the street. But I don't think I've ever gotten my balance back quite the same as before. So I'm not willing to try it.
Michael Marino is a brain injury rehab specialist at Jefferson Moss McGee Rehabilitation outside Philadelphia. He treated Susan, Jen, and Dom. He says despite all the work he does with patients, it is still very hard to predict who is going to make progress.
We've had many, many success stories, and you've spoken to patients who I certainly consider success stories and have really carved out, you know, improvements in their level of consciousness and in some cases really, really good quality of life. But I'd be lying to you if I said we didn't have patients that didn't do as well, patients that never regained consciousness, that never showed minimally conscious state.
And so the challenge remains, how to tell which patients can make a recovery, what kind of recovery, and what kind of future life awaits them.
That story was reported by Alan Yu.